Today, are we there yet? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, there's a remarkable division which has emerged between those calling that we've passed the bottom of the current stock market cycle and those who say we are right in the middle of a bear market rally which will peter out before a further and significantly deeper fall ahead. Why? Because on one hand, recent results from many stocks have been pretty good, although future performance, of course, is not guaranteed, while inflation, some are thinking, has peaked. Yet, on the other hand, central banks are still lifting rates and consumer confidence is tanking, while home prices are easing. And inflation is still way over target. So, who will be proved more right? Well, in this week's market review, we'll start in the US, go across to Europe and Asia, and end in Australia, as well as touch on metals, oil and crypto. But before I start, a quick request. If you value the content we produce, please do like the post and consider subscribing to receive future updates. This really makes a difference to us getting our message out, as views, likes and subscriptions drive the YouTube algo. And a word of thanks to all those who do support what we do. US stocks finished the week on solid footings, with traders assessing whether an inflation slowdown could soon make the Federal Reserve reduce the pace of its most aggressive tightening campaign in decades and prevent a hard landing. Defying the crowd of skeptics who dubbed the rebound a bear market rally, short covering or unwinding of hedges, the S&P 500 notched its fourth straight week of gains. That's the longest winning run since November, with big tech leading gains on Friday. The gauge has recouped half of its losses from January through to June, topping the so-called 50% Fibonacci retracement level. It's now sitting about 1.5% below its 200-day average, a threshold crossed, by the way, by the Russell 2000 gauge of small caps. In a session of anemic volume, though, battered chip makers led the charge. Mega caps like Apple and Tesla drove the NASDAQ 100 beyond its technical bull market threshold, following a surge of over 20% from June lows. As equities pushed higher, Wall Street's fear gauge crumbled. The Volatility Index slumped back below 20. That's the average level since its inception. And the VIX notched its late eighth straight week of declines, the longest such stretch since 2019. And meanwhile, the S&P 500's 14-day relative strength index, the RSI, topped 70, which is seen by some traders as one indication of an overbought market. In the next few weeks, there will be a crucial set of issues to determine the sustainability of the rally. With the earnings season almost over, economic reports mixed at best, and many Fed speakers unwilling to sound too dovish, some analysts see the chance of a breather ahead. To Matt Maley at Miller Tabak, stocks are indeed getting overbought on a very short-term basis, so a decline or sideways move, quote, would not be the worst development in the world. For now, flows have been robust. Global equity funds lured $7.1 billion in the week through August the 10th, said the Bank of American strategist, citing EPFR global data. Bond funds saw inflows of $11.7 billion, while $4.3 billion were pulled out of cash. The music hasn't stopped, said Matt Bottolini, State Street Global Advisors head of SPDR America's research. The labour market continues to be positive, earnings growth continues to be positive, so largely, if there is a recession, it's going to be relatively shallow. Lindsay Bell, chief markets and money strategist at Ally, said the market's now entering what is often considered a sketchy period. Historically, September and October are notoriously volatile, sometimes featuring big stock market drops, she wrote. After a more than 10% rally since mid-June, a bearish seasonal trend is good reason to temper expectations. I expect this market to continue to be reactionary and driven by headlines until we have more clarity on where exactly inflation is headed as we approach 2023. The Consumer Price Index, one of the most universally followed gauges on inflation, showed zero growth in the United States for July after a 1.3% rise in June. And over the year to last month, the so-called CPI also slowed, expanding by 8.5% from a previous 9.1%. And the US Producer Price Index, meanwhile, fell 0.5% in July, reinforcing the theme of inflation in retreat from four-decade highs. and data on Friday showed US consumer sentiment climbed to a three-month high on firmer expectations about the economy and personal finances. Inflation expectations, though, were mixed, with consumers boosting their longer-term views for prices slightly while reducing their year-ahead outlook for costs. An expectation on five-year inflation ticked up to 3%. While this is not good news for the Fed, Jeffrey said in the report, the decision of whether the central bank hikes by 50 basis points or 75 basis points in September is going to depend on the August employment data and CPI that are released closer to the meeting next month. Minutes of the Federal Reserve's July meeting, slated for next week, will be also closely watched for further clues on the central bank's rate hiking plan. There were more hawkish comments from Federal Reserve officials who posited that interest rates could rise by as much as 1% by the end of the year. The Fed is far, far away from declaring victory on inflation, Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank President Neil Kashkari said at the week's Aspen Ideas Conference. Kashkari said he hasn't seen anything that changes the need to raise the Fed's policy rate to 3.9% by the year end and to 4.4% by the end of 2023. The rate is currently at 2.25 to 2.5%. San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, in an interview with the Financial Times, also warned it's far too early for the US central bank to declare victory in its fight against inflation. But she said that a half a point percent raise was her baseline, but did not rule out a third consecutive 0.75% point raise at the central bank's next policy meeting in September, but noted the fight against inflation is far from over. Calling inflation unacceptably high, Chicago Fed President Charles Evans said he believes the Fed will likely need to lift its policy rate to 3.25 to 3.5% this year and to 3.75% to 4% by the end of next year, in line with what Fed Chair Jerome Powell signaled after the central bank's latest meeting in July. And Fed Bank of Richmond President Thomas Barkin was the latest official to call for continued rate increases while acknowledging that this week's inflation figures were encouraging. While we know the Fed has shifted to data dependency, and a lot of data falls between July and September meetings, including two inflation and job reports, there's plenty of wriggle room yet. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average added 1.27% to 33,761. The Nasdaq was up 2.09% to 13,047. And the S&P 500 gained 1.73% to 4,280. Technology stocks were underpinned by a nearly 3% jump in semiconductor stocks, as dip buying in Micron Technology and Nvidia Corporation continued after the duo plunged earlier this week on profit warnings. As well as rallying chip stocks, big tech was also in the ascendancy, with Apple up more than 2% after the tech giant reportedly told iPhone suppliers to ramp up production amid expectations for sales to remain steady despite a slowing market. Tech gained about 2% this week on easing fears of a deep recession and signs of easing inflation that has pressurized US Treasury yields. Treasury yields have come down, allowing the sector to be valued higher than it was before, boosting the mega cap tech stocks that dominate the equity indices, Jimmy Lee, the founder and CEO of the Wealth Consulting Group, said on Thursday. The idea that we're not going to be in a bad recession, and a recession could be short-lived, Lee added, has also played a role in the recent run-up in big tech. And yet, the 210 inversion signal remains for a recession ahead, so go figure. Energy, meanwhile, lagged the market's moves higher as oil prices slipped more than 2%. The International Energy Agency and the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries provided differing views on their demand forecasts ahead, with the former raising its forecast for demand growth in 2022 due to gas to oil switching, while the latter cut its forecast, citing slowing world growth. WTI crude was down 2.61% to $91.88, while Brent was down 1.6% to $98.01, but both were higher across the week. The earnings front served up mixed quarterly results as Toast jumped while Illumina slumped. Toast lifted its full-year earnings guidance after reporting a narrower-than-expected quarterly loss, driven by increasing demand for its restaurant payment technology. Its shares were up by more than 7%. Illumina, however, fell more than 8% after delivering gloomy guidance that fell short of Wall Street estimates following second-quarter results that missed on both the top and bottom lines. And Rivian Automotive was flat after forecasting a deeper annual loss, though investors appeared to take solace from production guidance that remained unchanged despite supply chain issues. In other news, Peloton Interactive jumped more than 13% as the exercise equipment maker reportedly readied more job cuts and aimed for price hikes to strengthen its balance sheet. Now, over in Europe, the stock markets there edged higher on Friday in cautious trading after the UK economy contracted in the second quarter. The DAX in Germany traded 0.74% higher to 13,795. The CAC 40 in France rose 0.14% to 6,553. And the UK's FTSE 100 traded 0.47% higher to 7,500. The UK economy shrank in the 3 months through to June for the first quarter in five, with gross domestic product falling just 0.1%, a slightly better outcome than the 0.2% expected, but a sharp drop from the 0.8% gain posted in the previous quarter. The economy had grown for five straight quarters since the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, but the Bank of England forecast last week that it's expected to head into a long recession later this year as the global surge in inflation puts intense pressure on discretionary spending is playing out. Inflation data from France and Spain offer different pictures, with France CPI climbing 0.3% on the month in July, while Spanish CPI fell by the same amount. In corporate news, Flutter stocks rose 7.7% after the world's largest online betting firm said it expects a turnaround in the second half of the year after posting a 20% fall in first half earnings. And Roche stock rose 1.1% after the Swiss drug maker announced it has received approval from the US Food and Drugs Administration for its Xofluza drug to treat influenza in children. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei 225 index rallied 2.62% to 28,546 in catch-up trade after a holiday on Thursday. Hong Kong's Hang Seng index added 0.46% to 20,175, and China's Shanghai Composite fell 0.15% to 3,276. Sentiment, though, towards China was dealt a new blow by a three-day lockdown in Yiwu, a major commodity and manufacturing hub in the Zhejiang province. The city was placed in a partial lockdown earlier this week and was put in a complete lockdown on Thursday, according to the South China Morning Post. China's economy is still reeling from a series of economically challenging COVID lockdowns imposed earlier this year, with investors wary of any more such measures. A lockdown in a major commodity hub could spell more trouble for China's beleaguered industrial sector, which unexpectedly shrank in July. Manufacturing stocks were among the worst performers on the blue chip index on Friday. Gold traded to 1,817, so gold's naysayers were proved wrong as it returned above the 1,800 level. At Friday's settlement, both futures of gold on New York's COMEX and the spot price of bullion were back above the 1,800 zone, finishing up for a fourth straight week, and for the week it rose almost 1.5%. This will be an interesting test for gold, as 1,800 could represent an interesting rotation point from a technical perspective if there is no desire to see it above here, but ultimately the case for bullish gold remains quite compelling, said Craig Earlham, analyst at online trading platform Onya. The fact that it continues to hold on to the bulk of the gains without any significant correction may suggest there's still an appetite for it, with slower tightening seen as a favourable outcome, he added. Both COMEX Gold and the spot price have gained more than 5% over the past 4 weeks. Gold's gains came after the dollar, which is a contrarian trade to the yellow metal, weakened this week on ebbing US inflation data. The DXY was at 105.67, actually up 0.56% on the day, and it's still very strong, but lower than the recent high of 108. Gold is supposed to be a hedge against inflation, but it has not been able to hold up to that billing for most of the past 2 years since hitting record highs above $2,100 in August 2020. One reason for that has been the rallying dollar, which is up by 11% this year after a 6% gain in 2021 on expectations of strong rate hikes by the Federal Reserve to curb inflation, currently, of course, near four-decade highs. The S&P ASX 200 eased 0.54% on Friday, but was still up for the week in the fourth consecutive weekly advance. Weakness came from several major miners in the country who depend on China as an export destination. BHP Group, the world's largest miner, dropped 0.82%, while Rio Tinto traded flat, actually just slightly higher. Fortescue Metals was 0.7% lower at $18.94, and shares in lithium miners also came under pressure. Out of the indices' 11 categories, 8 fell, led by a 2% drop in real estate shares. Energy gained the most, up 2.3%. Woodside was the indices performer with a jump of 3.7% to $32.77. New Hope closely followed, powering up 4.3% to $4.40. And meanwhile, Santos rallied 0.8% to $7.18. The Australian Financial Review's Talk Street reported on Friday that Santos had bought a gas pipeline project to connect its long-contested Narrabri gas project in New South Wales to the East Coast market. Shares in Stanmore Resources leapt by 11% nearly after posting record half-year profits. And shares in IAG lifted 1.1% to $4.66 after the insurer swung to a $347 million profit in the 2022 financial year following a loss last year. Supermarket giant Woolworths Group dipped 0.1% to $38.05, and the company gained the tick of approval from the competition regulator on its planned acquisition of online marketplace retailer MyDeal. MyDeal shares rose 1%. Commonwealth Bank was the only major bank to post a loss on Friday. It slipped 0.5% to $100.35. In contrast, NAB rose 0.8% to $30.78. ANZ nudged up 0.5% to 24.02, and Westpac gained 0.8% to 22.66. CBA warned of an economic slowdown ahead and irrational mortgage pricing. The head of CBA has called out rival financial institutions for going after risky and unprofitable loans as mortgage price competition became fiercer. CBA avoided participating, quote, in elevated levels of price competition for mortgages in the 6 months ended the 30th of June, according to the CEO, Matt Common. Common said that that wait-and-see attitude was the reason CBA's mortgage growth of 7.4% for the fiscal year was slightly below the average of its peer group. And sleep disorder and breathing devices company ResMed fell 3.1% despite reporting a $250 million windfall gain in 2022, taking net profit 64% higher. The main index gained 0.2% this week. On Tuesday, the RBA will release the minutes of its August meeting. The markets will be looking for insights into the RBA's decision at the meeting when they raised rates by 0.5%, bringing the cash rate to 1.85%. Australia publishes employment changes on Thursday, and the labour market is expected to deaccelerate in July and post gains of around 40,000. This follows the June gain of 88,400, which was higher than expected. The unemployment rate is expected to remain around the 3.5%. And the Reserve Bank of New Zealand will meet on Wednesday. They've been at the forefront of aggressive rate hikes by central banks and are expected to raise the cash rate by 50 basis points to 3%. This would mark a fourth successive 50 basis point increase, with further rate increases expected in the coming months. Along with the rate decision, the RBNZ will publish revised growth and inflation forecasts. And we did a show the other day showing just how significantly impacted house prices was by these rises. In crypto, Bitcoin slipped back to 24,366, having been at its highest level since June the 13th, as enthusiasm over declining US inflation combined with news that the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock, was launching a Bitcoin private fund. While some commentators hoped for Bitcoin to tackle resistance closer to 30,000 US as a result, others remained cautious, with suspicions that a fresh downtrend could ensue ahead. Ether, though, fared a little better, up 3.41% to 1,949. And so to that question, are we there yet? So do the share market lows seen in June represent a low point for global equity markets? An AFR Cantley article says, having focused for so long on the risks of a recession, investors are right to consider the risk that they could be caught out being too bearish when the global economy is heading for a soft landing. But while the profit season is mainly about zooming in on the minute detail of individual companies, it's also useful to keep one eye on the bigger picture. Despite the incredible disruptions of the last 2 years, the pandemic, crippling global supply dislocations, start-up economic reopenings, the highest inflation seen in generations, profit margins in the US had never been higher, and Australian profit margins were also elevated, sitting around levels decades high. Nothing out of the recent June quarter reporting season in the US or the first weeks of the ASX profit season has changed that picture. Margins have held up reasonably well, in part because companies have pushed through price increases that consumers have so far at least been willing to pay. But Rob Almeida, global investment strategist and portfolio manager at investment giant MFS, says it's useful to think about how profit margins got to this point. the last 2 years, when an avalanche of global stimulus payments sparked the surge in demand that has delivered us this inflation spike, is clearly part of the answer. But Almeida argues this is really a story that's been building for more than a decade, when central banks flooded the world with cheap money to try and spark an economic recovery in the wake of the GFC, and never really turned off the taps. This capital wasn't used to invest in productive capacity to drive organic revenue growth, but instead used to fund fat capital returns, high dividends and share buybacks, and acquisitions to drive inorganic growth across most sectors. This explains why the 2010s produced outsized profits but saw a feeble economic expansion and historic gap in wealth between the owners of capital and labour. The excess of this last business cycle was corporate leverage and profits. Pandemic stimulus did nothing to change this picture. Almeida says that instead of investing in plant and equipment or research and development, the government issued previously unimaginable quantities of debt so that consumers could buy more goods than the economy could produce. The result? Inflation. Almeida's point is simple. Until these excesses are washed out of the system, until corporate profits have come back down, until the retail investors who are yet to meaningfully sell stocks have done so, it's hard to make the case that markets have bottomed and are headed for a durable economic recovery. There are signs in the ASX reporting season that some of the forces behind the strong profit growth of the past decade are indeed starting to reverse. Consider fund manager Mark Howski, who argues that the four main drivers historically high margins, low interest rates, low wages growth, partially through better efficiency, but also due to utilization of cheaper offshore labor, lower capital intensity, thanks to globalized supply chains, and lower tax rates, particularly in the US, are all, well, questionable. The last few weeks have provided anecdotal evidence that these tailwinds are turning into headwinds. Interest rates are clearly rising, and while we've seen only muted increases in financing costs from the companies that have reported so far, average borrowing costs at property giant Mirvac, for example, rose from 3.4% to 3.9% at June the 30th. 2023 is looking to see more pressure. There are also some surprising implications of higher inflation rates. Rio Tinto, for example, took an earnings hit of almost $300 million because rising inflation and discount rates meant it needs to put aside more to rehabilitate mine sites when they close. And wage growth is clearly on the rise, perhaps more viscerally at QBE, which pushed through 2 wage increases in 3 months for its staff. Commonwealth Bank is yet to complete negotiations on its enterprise bargaining agreement, but it's braced for a significant jump. And supply chain pressures have been seen across the ASX in the first weeks of the reporting season, with retailer Baby Bunting, which reported on Friday, providing a neat example. Not only did it miss $3 million of sales because supplies of top-selling prams have been restricted, but it lifted inventory by 20% to mitigate further delays. The pressure on capital intensity has also been highlighted by explosive giant Orica, which supersized a capital raising for an acquisition to give it more than $200 million of spare cash to manage supply chain issues. Given the state of pandemic-ravaged government budgets, tax reductions are off the table. Indeed, booming coal miner Corando Global Resources is already seeing royalties rise, but now faces a new royalty regime in Queensland. Given what we've seen in other parts of the world, tax hits on the energy sector could hardly come as a surprise. So the question will be, how are these trends borne out across the rest of the ASX reporting season? But as interest rates keep rising and economic growth slows, hopefully bringing down inflation with it, the pressure on corporate revenues is likely to increase, but their costs, interest payments, wages, inventory, taxes, are moving higher in what Almeida argues is a structural change. He'll add in the costs of ESG as another rising burden. Which brings us back to our original question. Can the market really be at the bottom if the reversion in global profits is only just getting started? Well, it is possible if valuations have come down far enough to account for the fall in profits, or if a soft landing means profits won't fall as much as feared. After the rally we've seen since mid-June and the softer CPI print on Wednesday night, that's clearly worth thinking about. But Almeida has a nice analogy to explain where we might be in the cycle. Market rallies, he says, are like an event, sort of like a party that everyone wants to attend, but market bottoms are a process, more like a hangover, where the excesses of the night before are only fixed over time. Historically, markets have tended to bottom when investors give up, stop caring, vow never to invest again, and no longer ask, is this the bottom? And Almeida says, I've lived through that twice. and I don't think we're there yet. But when investors stop asking whether we are, then we will be, which I think is a good way to think about it, which is why I still believe that there is more downside ahead. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.